I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said on Tuesday the United States is deeply concerned by the loss of life in an Israeli attack on a residential building in northern Gaza.
This was a horrifying incident with a horrifying result.
Gaza's health ministry said at least 93 Palestinians were killed and missing and dozens wounded in an Israeli strike on a residential building in the northern Gaza town of Beit Lahia on Tuesday.
It is another reminder of why we need to see an end to this war.
Israeli lawmakers have voted to ban the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, from operating within Israel, raising fears this will further worsen the already dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees employs thousands of people who run the enclave's schools, its primary healthcare clinics, and other social services, as well as distributing humanitarian aid. Israeli lawmakers on Monday banned the agency from operating within Israel. The move raises concerns about UNRWA's ability to provide relief in Gaza and has alarmed Western allies who fund it. Since Israel launched its war following the October 7 attacks in 2023, nearly the entire Gazan population now relies on UNRWA for basics including food, water and hygiene supplies. The UN said in August that 9 UNRWA staff may have been involved in the October 7 attacks and fired them. Israeli authorities have long called for the agency to be dismantled, arguing it fosters anti-Israeli sentiment among its staff and in its wider social mission. UNRWA strongly disputes this characterization.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. This is VOA News. Russia test-fired missiles over distances of thousands of kilometers on Tuesday to simulate what it called a massive nuclear response to an enemy first strike. Russia has been signaling for weeks to the West that Moscow will respond if the United States and its allies allow Kyiv to fire long-range missiles deep into Russia. NATO said Monday that North Korea has sent troops to Western Russia, something Moscow has not denied. Thousands of Russians, including soldiers, have sought asylum in the West since Moscow's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, although only a fraction of their applications have been approved. However, France this month allowed several Russian army deserters to enter the country to seek refugee status. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Alexander, who does not want to give his family name for fear of political retaliation, was a soldier in the Russian army. He is now living in the French city of Caen, along with his wife, Irina. In January 2022, as Russia was preparing its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Alexander was told his unit was heading to Russian-occupied Crimea for military exercises. He eventually managed to flee the army. A French court ruled in 2023 that Russians who refuse to fight can claim refugee status, but most are unable to travel overseas to lodge an asylum application. In a landmark case, France this month granted permission for Alexander and Irina, along with 8 other Russians, to enter the country and apply for asylum. The decision followed months of advocacy and campaigning by organizations like Russie Liberté, which encourage Russians to desert the army. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Donald Trump is celebrating his weekend rally at Madison Square Garden, a rally that featured crude and racist insults. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Trump says there's never been an event so beautiful.
An absolute love fest, and it was my honor to be involved.
He's also used love fest to describe the Capitol riot. Speaking today at his Florida resort, Trump did not mention the event's racist comments about Latinos, Jews, Palestinians, or black people, nor sexual insults against Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton, nor this.
There's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
The Trump campaign distanced itself from the joke, but not the other comments. Sagar Magani, Washington.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bucky, Washington. Today's Wednesday, October 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vice President Kamala Harris delivered a major speech Tuesday night in Washington, D.C., 6 days before the November 5th elections.
It is time to turn the page on the drama and the conflict, the fear and division. It is time for a new generation of leadership in America.
We'll speak to a first-time immigrant U.S. voter. The International Organization for Migration says Sudan's displacement crisis is growing worse. The WHO says tuberculosis is on the rise as the world's top infectious killer disease. Liberia's finance minister says his country secured a $210 million loan from the IMF to address urgent fiscal and balance of payment needs.
One of the first things I had to do was to ensure Liberia's approval in the extended credit facility program of the IMF. We got $210 million to show up our reserve.
Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa.
Vice President Kamala Harris, the Democratic Party candidate in the November 5th election, delivered a major speech on Tuesday night in Washington, D.C., near the White House. The event was held at the same spot where then-President Donald Trump spoke to his supporters on January 6, 2021, and asked them to march to the Capitol and try to stop the certification. She urged Americans to put country above party and above self when they vote on November 5th.
America, for too long, we have been consumed with too much division, chaos, and mutual distrust. And it can be easy then to forget a simple truth. It doesn't have to be this way. It is time to stop pointing fingers. We have to stop pointing fingers and start locking arms. It is time to turn the page on the drama and the conflict, the fear and division. It is time for a new generation of leadership in America. And I am ready to offer that leadership as the next president of the United States of America. And look, I'll be honest with you, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. But here's what I promise you. I will always listen to you, even if you don't vote for me. I will always tell you the truth, even if it is difficult to hear. I will work every day to build consensus and reach compromise to get things done. And if you give me the chance to fight on your behalf, there is nothing in the world that will stand in my way. So look, in less than 90 days, either Donald Trump or I will be in the Oval Office. On day one, if elected, Donald Trump would walk into that office with an enemies list. When elected, I will walk in with a to-do list. Full of priorities of what I will get done for the American people. And I will work with everyone, Democrats, Republicans and independents, to help Americans who are working hard and still struggling to get ahead. I have been honored to serve as Joe Biden's vice president, but I will bring my own experiences and ideas to the Oval Office. My presidency will be different because the challenges we face are different. Our top priority as a nation 4 years ago was to end the pandemic and rescue the economy. Now, our biggest challenge is to lower costs, costs that were rising even before the pandemic and that are still too high. And I've heard from so many of you who are facing even greater financial pressures. And as president, I will fight to help first-time home buyers with your down payment. For years, Yes, we have heard excuses about why America can't build enough housing. Enough with the excuses. I'm going to cut the red tape and work with the private sector and local governments to speed up building and get it done.
Vice President Kamala Harris speaking Tuesday night in Washington, D.C. Vice President Harris made her closing argument to voters 1 week before Election Day in Washington, D.C. VOA's Jackson Bunganyi was there and tells Douglas Mpuga that there was a lot of excitement at the rally.
There was a lot of excitement at the National Mall here in Washington, D.C. in a major rally at the Ellipse, which was within the site of the White House. Vice President Kamala Harris made her closing case to voters a few days before election. It's 7 days before election today. The elections will be held on November the 5th, next Tuesday. The location where this rally was held holds a symbolic weight, as it was the site of former President Donald Trump's rally on January 6, 2021. And Kamala Harris addressed thousands of people. She drew on her background as a prosecutor to critic her Republican opponent, Donald Trump, for his record and past statements. She condemned his rhetoric, particularly quote-unquote enemy within comments, framing him as a leader that is unstable and that is obsessed with revenge or consumed with grievance. Kamala also emphasized her plans on economic reform, reproductive rights, and other key issues, basically contrasting her vision with what she described as a Trump's pursuit for unchecked power.
Jackson, this rally was held in the nation's capital. Do you think she was preaching to the choir, or maybe it was meant to be addressed to the nation?
You know, Puga, this speech was a strategic move in some ways, aimed at a crucial block in the electorate, who were the undecided voters, or what the campaign, Kamala Harris's campaign, called the conflicted voters, who are wary of, on one hand, wary of Trump's conduct, yet they're also uncertain about Harris's ability to bring about what they say is meaningful change. So to these voters, she promised a presidency that was focused on unity and progress, saying that when elected, she will walk into the office with a to-do list for the American people, while saying that her opponents would walk into the White House with an enemies list.
VOA's Jackson Bunganyi speaking from the Ellipse in Washington, D.C., with Douglas Mpuga. As early voting continues in several states across the United States, VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Hussein Kiflu, a first-time voter in America. Kiflu, who immigrated from the African nation of Ethiopia, describes the experience as very special.
It was my first time to vote in America, and the experience, considering where I came from, where people's will vote is rigged blatantly, it was, I can say that it was one hell of an experience, a good experience, because whatever comes, ultimately, I still believe that the law prevails, the rule of law prevails in America.
So it must have been a relief to you, win or lose. It's quite a different experience, like the one you had back in Africa.
Correct, yeah. It's a totally different experience. Like, the difference is like day and night.
How do you feel about this experience, given what you went through, where you came from?
You know, the last time I voted, it was in May 2005, in my country of birth, Ethiopia. The vote was blatantly, the results of that election was rigged in broad daylight. When Ethiopians tried to protest, many of them were gunned down. Some of us ended up in prison. And because of that, look where Ethiopia ended up. Now it's total chaos. Civil war everywhere on the basis of ethnicity. I don't think America would come to that. You know, I think it must have been Winston Churchill who said this. You know, all forms of government are bad, but still democracy is the best form of governance. So that's how I see it.
Hussein Kiflu is a first-time immigrant voter from Ethiopia. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Dallas, Texas. VOA's Paul Undiho spoke with some early voters in Washington, D.C., and here are some of their perspectives.
I worked for Roe v. Wade 50 years ago and helping to get that passed. So it's very disconcerting to see what's happened now. And people say, oh, it's up to the state. Well, what if you work? And what if you get transferred to another state with your job and that state doesn't support your values? You know, what do you do? Do you say, oh, I can't take that job? Or it's a shame. I really hate to see what's happened to women's rights.
You can take the woman's right away to have an abortion and then offer nothing in the health care process. I myself find that my medications that are necessary for my health and to be here talking to you right now are affordable, and they weren't before. I'd had to take out loans to get my insulin. I can afford it out of my pocket now. So those are issues for me too. I have to concern myself for my neighbors, their health. I just think it's ridiculous to rip away things that should be not my decision.
Absolutely petrified at the thought that Kamala Harris would be president because I don't like her policies. I like the way the country ran when he was in charge, not liking his personality. Absolutely, I don't like his personality, but I like his policies.
But I voted for Trump because I think Trump has the best ideas within helping the community and the United States and helping with tax cuts. And yeah, I don't know. I just really like Trump.
The views of some early voters in Washington, D.C. They spoke with VOA's Paul Undijo. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 30th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Liberia's finance minister says he had a fruitful engagement with the International Monetary Fund at the IMF during the just-concluded meetings in Washington, D.C. Augustine Ngafua says the encounter resulted in the approval by the IMF of a 40-month, $210 million loan. The sum will address urgent fiscal and balance of payment needs, including beefing up the Central Bank of Liberia reserve. Liberia currently has a $2.5 billion foreign debt. Gafuan also tells me that Liberia is prioritizing the fight against corruption through several means, including persecuting alleged perpetrators.
It's about it, you know, I came to this job just a little over a month ago. And that one of the first things I had to do was to ensure Liberia's approval in the Extended Credit Facility Program of the IMF. It's a 40-month program, and we got $210 million to show up our reserve. And that coming to Washington, D.C., to attend the IMF World Bank annual meetings was an opportune time to brief partners on the progress we've made and the challenges we've encountered. So the meetings have been very productive.
In layman's terms now, does this mean an additional loan? And what would it be used for?
Well, the $210 million support does not come in one tranche. It comes within a 40-month period. We have agreed benchmarks. The IMF team will be in Liberia to begin some review by the 6th of November. Actually, the funds are a very low interest-bearing facility extended by the IMF. This fund will be used to beef up the reserve at the central bank. The threshold for good monetary and economic health is that a country should have its reserve should be able to finance at least 3 months of imports. Liberia's reserve position is such that we can only finance a little over 2 months of imports. So we are beefing up the reserve to meet that minimum threshold and show to the world that our economic indicators are sound. So it is not an on-budget support. It is to beef up the central bank's reserve. The government took some funds from the central bank's reserve that this government we have to replenish. So we are budgeting nothing less than $15 million to start that replenishment process next year.
As I follow developments from Liberia, I think I may be right to say recently the Central Bank of Liberia has had some problems. So what are some of the economic challenges facing your government, including the Central Bank?
Well, the Central Bank of Liberia has its own issues. The government has its own issues, although there are other opportunities. I'm not the chief monetary official of the government. But in terms of challenges, one of them that is very teething is our huge debt situation. We have a debt stock now that stands at $2.5 billion. What this means is that our debt-to-GDP ratio is around 56%. It is termed as moderate risks of debt distress, but we are verging on high rates of debt distress. So we are going to be implementing some what we call prudent debt management strategy. Also, the debt service obligation is taking bigger and bigger chunks of the fiscal space.
Augustine Gafuan is Liberia's finance minister. He spoke with me in Washington, D.C. after attending the just-concluded IMF World Bank meetings. The International Organization for Migration warns that Sudan's displacement crisis is growing worse as the number of people fleeing fighting, hunger, and sexual abuse escalates. IOM Director General Amy Pope, reporting from Port Sudan, says 11 million people now are uprooted from their homes, and more than 3 million refugees have fled to neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein has the story.
The war in Sudan, the world's largest displacement crisis, has uprooted more than 14 million people. The International Organization for Migration says 11 million have been displaced inside Sudan. This, says IOM Director General Amy Pope, is up by 200,000 just since September. Speaking from Port Sudan, she tells journalists in Geneva the number of people who have fled across borders as refugees has increased to 3.1 million. She says more than half of those displaced are women, and more than a quarter are children under the age of five.
Unfortunately, many of them have been forced to flee repeatedly. They have little access to shelter, they have little access to livelihoods, and getting their basic needs met has been very, very difficult. The scale of the displacement and humanitarian needs are growing every day. Frankly, half of the population now needs help. People don't have access to shelter. They don't have access to clean drinking water. They don't have access to health care.
Pope warns disease is spreading fast, as is hunger, with one in every two Sudanese struggling to find enough food to survive. Meanwhile, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, condemns the escalating hostilities in Al Jazeera state, which he says is worsening the risk of attacks against civilians. His spokesperson, Saif Magongo, says the rapid support forces reportedly have killed hundreds of people amid widespread looting in this region. He says the RSF also reportedly has detained and ill-treated civilians from targeted villages.
Further, there are reports of burning of crops at a time when over 25 million Sudanese are facing acute food insecurity because of the ongoing conflict. Destruction of crops in a region considered the country's breadbasket can only exacerbate an already catastrophic situation.
He says thousands of families reportedly have been displaced from Al Jazeera state because of the violence, adding to the already dire displacement crisis in the country. High Commissioner Turk is calling on leaders of both the RSF and Sudanese armed forces to promptly take measures to de-escalate the situation and to stop rights violations by their forces. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
At least 8.2 million people were diagnosed with tuberculosis in 2023. The World Health Organization says this is the highest number ever recorded since it began global TB monitoring in 1995, placing TB as the leading infectious killer disease last year. At the same time, multi-drug-resistant TB remains a public health crisis, with treatment success rates standing at 68% globally. Maureen Odhiambo reports.
Tuberculosis continues to claim millions of lives around the world each year.
The World Health Organization, WHO, says there are major hindrances to ending the disease, including limited access to health services and quality care, inadequate health infrastructure, human resources for health and social protection. Teresa Kaseiva, the Director Global TB Program at WHO, says the Global Tuberculosis Report for 2024 indicates mixed progress in the fight against TB, with the disease facing a lack of funding. She says with only 26% of worldwide funding for TB, it will not be possible to eradicate the disease.
TB response, especially in low- and middle-income countries, is important but insufficient to cover essential TB service needs. The report emphasizes that sustained financial investment is crucial for the success of TB prevention diagnosis and treatment efforts. We have new tools for TB screening and diagnosis. We have much better, shorter, and safer treatment and TB preventive treatment options, even for people with multi-drug resistant TB.
TB affects people in 30 high burden countries, with India, Indonesia, China, the Philippines and Pakistan accounting for 56% of the global disease burden.
The fact that TB still kills and sickens so many people is an outrage. When we have the tools to prevent it, detect it, and treat it, WHO urges all countries to make good on the concrete commitments that they have made to expand the use of those tools and to end TB.
Global funding for TB prevention and care dropped further in 2023 and remains far between target, with low- and middle-income countries, which bear 98% of the TB burden, facing major funding shortages. The TB division chief at the U.S. Agency for International Aid, USAID, Sherry Vincent, says the agency is committed to fighting the disease.
We have a global TB strategy that goes from 2023 to 2030 that focuses on, in our 24 priority countries, ensuring that 90% of individuals with TB are diagnosed, initiated on treatment. USAID remains committed to leading the global TB response and increasing our efforts, working together with all partners, with governments, civil society, communities, those affected with TB.
The report shows good news for some African countries, including boosting TB diagnosis rates. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many countries maintained TB notification services, ensuring that cases were detected and treated. In Nigeria, which has the large TB burden, case notification nearly tripled over the past 5 years to 285,000 cases in 2022 from 106,000 cases in 2018. Improvement in the management of HIV infection, a significant driver of TB, has also bolstered TB detection rates in the region. The WHO says significant progress is needed to reach targets for reducing the disease set for 2027 ahead of the second UN high-level meeting. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
Morocco's King Mohammed VI has welcomed French President Emmanuel Macron to Morocco, kicking off a state visit with a series of bilateral agreements, including major investments in renewable energy and transportation. The Associated Press says Macron's visit on Monday comes months after he changed France's long-standing public position and backed Morocco's autonomy plan for the disputed Western Sahara. Morocco is the top destination for French investment in Africa, and France is Morocco's top trader partner. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.
VOA Africa presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in brief, airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.